Good afternoon. My name is Bill Lawrence. I'm the dean at Perkins School of Theology and professor of American Church History. Allow me to introduce our two speakers for this occasion. I'm going to introduce both of them, and then the first of the two speakers will come up, give his presentation. Immediately after the conclusion of the first presentation, the second presentation will be given. And then, as time permits, we'll see if there are opportunities for questions. Chief David O. Brown is a 30-year veteran of the Dallas Police Department. As chief of police, he commands a department comprised of over 4,000 employees and oversees an annual operating budget of $426 million. At the request of the city manager of Dallas, Chief Brown served as an interim assistant city manager for the city of Dallas and directed operations in the areas of code compliance, environmental and health services, equipment and building services, library services, parks and recreation, and cultural affairs. It warms the heart of every academic to know that we have a chief of police who knows something about libraries. All of these departments that he oversaw in that interim role included 2,700 employees and had an operating budget of over $230 million. So a chief of police, an assistant city manager, each of those is a kind of position that requires exceptional training in specified areas, but also the ability to manage large numbers of persons and large institutions with complex budgets. Chief Brown has been well educated for all of these roles. He has a Bachelor of Science and an MBA. He is a graduate as well of the Federal Bureau of Investigation National Academy, the FBI National Executive Institute, the Senior Management Institute for Police, the National Counterterrorism Seminar in Tel Aviv, Israel, and the United States Secret Service Dignitary Protection Seminar in Washington, D.C. He also holds the Master Peace Officer and Police Instructor certificates from the state of Texas. Please join me in acknowledging with great thanks the presence of our first speaker, from whom we will hear in a few minutes, Chief David O. Brown. Immediately after we hear from Chief Brown, we'll hear from our second speaker, Dr. Robert A. Hunt. Dr. Hunt was born in Dallas in 1955. After attending schools in Austin and Richardson, he went to the University of Texas in Austin, where he majored in history. He then came to Perkins School of Theology as a student, where he earned the Master of Theology degree. Here at Perkins, he served as pastor of Bethany United Methodist Church in Austin, Texas. And then, in 1985, he and his wife Lillian moved to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, where they taught at the seminary, the School of Theology in Malaysia. And then, from 1993 to 1997, at Trinity Theological College in Singapore. He also began graduate studies, earning in 1994 a PhD from the University of Malaya, focusing on Christian missions to and relationships with Muslims in Southeast Asia. Dr. Hunt remains to this day our go-to expert on Christian-Muslim relations and has an extraordinary range of knowledge about the many different dimensions of Islam here in the United States and abroad. From 1997 to 2004, Dr. Hunt was the pastor of the English-speaking United Methodist Church in Vienna. That's not Vienna, Virginia. That's Vienna, the original one, Austria. He also was an adjunct professor at Webster University in Vienna. Here at Perkins, he is the director of the Global Theological Education Program. He teaches courses in world religions, interreligious dialogue and mission. Under the auspices of the Global Theological Education Program, he administers a project that takes members of the Perkins faculty and the students whom they have enrolled in their courses to teach courses in distant places with which the students are not familiar, but the faculty member is. And over the course of the year, each academic year, we have approximately five such courses that are taught literally on every continent of the globe except Antarctica. We're still working on that one. But to have a faculty member teach the Gospel of Luke from the perspective of the poor people in El Salvador or India, to have courses taught in areas of specialization in regions as diverse as Johannesburg, South Africa, Tizay, France, Beijing, Delhi, and so forth. It's an exceptional program that he leads. Please join me in acknowledging and thanking our second speaker, Dr. Robert Hunt. Chief Brown, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the welcoming. And so I was kind of surveying the room as you began eating your lunch, and I noticed that you all looked like you needed a cop joke. And so I'm going to go ahead and fulfill the appetite where I really get a sense of, with my policing skills, that you really need to laugh right now. So these buttons on our uniform used to be, and the badge, by the way, used to be made out of copper. And turn of the century, at the beginning of the law enforcement, the advent of law enforcement in turn of a century, all the criminals used to, as a nickname, call the police officer coppers. And it is the reason why we are called cops today. It comes from the original copper buttons and copper badges. So that's a little bit of police trivia. So today, these buttons and badges, the buttons themselves are a little bit plastic now. So, and it's really how we got our new nickname. You know, young people don't know anything about the origination of the coppers. It's the reason how we got our new nicknames from young people call us Popo. And that means too po to buy copper. And the last button on every police uniform is a black button. The very last button on every police uniform is just a black, regular button. And when we're overweight and you start seeing that black button, we're members of the Black Button Club. So my waistline is still holding tight, but it's, again, I'm not a member of the Black Button Club. I may be bald, but I'm not fat. So now that I got you laughing pretty good, let me talk about something that's no laughing matter. Crime touches us all. And if you don't know anything about what's happening in the city of Dallas as it relates to crime, I have a good report relates to crime in Dallas. Crime is down today for the 11th consecutive year, unprecedented. The previous consecutive year records in Dallas were from 89 to 95, seven consecutive years, and this would be the 11th consecutive year. Crime is down in Dallas 13% as of today. And I'm going to roll through this pretty quickly, and the most exciting number is the murder rate. The murder rate today is down 25% year-to-date. The murder rate over that 11-year period is down 60%, 60%. And we're on track this year to have the lowest murder rate in Dallas's history. The previous record was the murder rate in 1930. So it's amazing. It doesn't lead the news, but it is an amazing 11-year decline in crime. What's attributed to that? We raised taxes in Dallas to hire over 700 additional officers beginning in 2004, 2005. And so we have more boots on the ground. The other side of that coin is we're using technology to fight crime in a way that we never have. Our young cops really understand how to use, they grew up with a computer, they really understand how to use license plate readers, cameras in public spaces, GPS equipment to track criminals much better. We're on the advent of using body cameras as cameras on our uniform to capture every interaction. And we have an intelligence center called the Fusion Center that creates information flow from the laptop computers in the squad cars from this central intelligence unit that sends out real-time information that helps our cops solve crime. So there's a good crime story to tell in Dallas that may not ever be lead the news, but I can tell you right now it is an exciting time to live in Dallas. Not only is it growing economically, but it's growing safe. And we're amongst the safest cities in the country, the safest big cities in the country, and it's something to be excited about. Of course, we wear badges, right? And I'm going to segue to another topic, is that we have a high standard of character for our department, for our officers, because they wear these badges. They're not just sworn to protect the public and to serve the public. They're also sworn to care of themselves in a certain way, above the basic standard. We're held to a higher standard because we wear these badges. Not only on duty, but we're held to a high standard for our off-duty behavior. And so officers are under investigation for something that might happen into their home that causes a police response. Our officers can't drive drunk. They lose their jobs. Our officer can't be in an environment for the public to see them in any untoward light. So we are held to the highest standards because we wear badges. But I was thinking about this the other day, and actually I was looking at a movie that talked about badges. And in this movie, it talked about everyone having to wear a badge, which references all of you. And I have a very active imagination since childhood, so my imagination really got me to thinking about, well, what badges would just regular folks have to wear? Because we all know that when you see an officer in uniform with their badge on, that they're sworn to do certain things. But you all in your really nice suits and ties, and the ladies in your really nice outfits, may not just automatically think that you are in the same position we are in. But I would argue that you are wearing a badge. Those that are married, you swore at that marriage ceremony to love your wife for the men. And women, I think this is biblical, you swore to respect your husbands. Amen. And those that are in business, who own companies or run companies or just regular work, you have an allegiance to work hard for that company and to represent it. And so you wear a badge. Those of you that are members of a church, you should tithe. You should support the pastor. You should conduct your personal life in a way that's representative of Christ. So you wear a badge. And so if you think about me and my badge, of course, you see it. And you may not necessarily see all the representations of badges you all wear. If you're a father, you have responsibility for your children. So you have badges that are unseen. And you are, as regular citizens, held to a higher standard, just like cops are, just like the coppers were at the very beginning. You ought to be holding yourself to these high standards, just like the public holds police officers to high standards. And so as a guiding principle for me and my decision makings in my role as a police chief, I really lean heavily on Galatians 5 in that 22nd verse, where it lists out the things we should all be doing as Christians. This Apostle Paul argues that we should be exhibiting love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, and temperance. That's our badge. That's the lifestyle we ought to be living. So I would hope that your takeaway from my talk today with you is that, yeah, the chief wore a badge and he was in uniform and we couldn't see his black button. But I, too, wear a badge. You know, you should be as a child. You have certain responsibilities towards your parents to act in a certain way. That's your back. Even as an adult child, you know, caring for your elderly parent in their time of need. That's your badge. Sometimes these badges we all wear are badges of courage. It's quite a high price to pay to wear a badge. You give up some of your things that you want to do maybe individually because you can't get in a car with folks that are not acting appropriately and still wear your badge and claim to be a certain person or have a certain faith or have a certain responsibility. So you all wear badges. I talk at a lot of police recruit graduations. I talk at a lot of retirements. And unfortunately, I have to speak at police funerals, both on duty and in line of duty deaths and natural deaths of police officers who served us well. So I have a cross section of police officers I talk to at various points in their career, at the beginning, when they're hired, when they retire, and at funerals. Here's what I've understood to be true from that experience, having to speak at those audiences. And I think it applies to you all, non-uniform wearing badge folk, is that the best cops live balanced lives. They do. I've seen them when they're hired. I've seen them when they retire. And I've seen their families at their funerals. And in every case, without question, the best cops live balanced lives. What do I mean by that? Most cops, when they're hired, they want to be a cop 24/7. They don't want to do anything but live, breathe, eat, and drink cop work. And I talk to them at the graduations to say, the best cops make time for their families. They are not a cop 24/7. If you are, who's going to raise your child? Who's going to love their wife? Who's going to care for their parents with a 24/7 outlook on this profession? The best cops live a balanced life. They continue with their hobbies. And if you're a hunter or a fisherman or you love playing sports, the best cops find time for their hobbies. Now, for you hunters, why you want to kill Bambi, I will never understand. I will never understand that. I had a cop tell me, well, Chief, Bambi takes pretty good. And I said, I just couldn't get that because I'm a city boy. So if you're a person of faith and you become a police officer, the best cops find a way to continue to attend church. The best cops go to soccer practice. They take out the trash. We are heroes in these uniforms. And if you're able to live the life that Christ has chosen for you, you're a hero. But you have to find time to maintain balance in your life. It makes you more effective at work. Cops that get in trouble with excessive force and violating our policies are the cops that are 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week cops. They are, in every case. The cops whose retirements I show up to and none of their family members show up to because they don't know them, because they've been a cop 24/7. They never were at home to raise their kids. Their kids don't know them. And mama's wondering how she's going to survive with him at home every day because she's not used to him being around the house. The best cops live balanced lives. And I would argue the best people live balanced lives. That you businessmen and women and young people who aspire to lead organizations, if your goal is to be a 24/7 CEO, I would argue that's a recipe for failure. You may be a successful business person, but you may be a failed father, a failed husband, failed church member. Not just the best cops live balanced lives. The best people live balanced lives. And that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. And so I'm going to end with a joke, since you should have laughed at my first joke, which I got to end with a joke. My 20 minutes is about to close, and it's a great joke. And I can tell this joke a lot of different ways, and so I always survey the audience to figure out how would I tell this joke. So I'm going to tell this joke from the woman's perspective, because Ms. Lack and Mr. Lack sponsored this event. Ms. Lack, this retired woman was speeding and pulled over for driving 100 miles an hour, which I'm sure you would never do. But she's speeding, and the cops pulled her over for driving 100 miles an hour, well past the speed limit. And the cop is at shift change, and so he's wanting not to work over his shift. And so as he approaches the lady, he asks, ma'am, what is your excuse for driving 100 miles an hour over the speed limit? And I don't want to write you a ticket, but if you give me an excuse that I hadn't heard before, I'll let you off. And so without hesitation, she says, well, officer, I'm recently divorced. And my husband, it was a female officer, by the way, left me for a cop that looks just like you. And I thought you were bringing him back. Now, Ms. Lack laughs too hard. Mr. Lack, you're in trouble. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your attentiveness. Thank you so much.
Oh, my. Well, I don't think I can. I don't have a joke to start with. I might try to tell a funny anecdote in the middle, but I'm kind of an academic in an academic role here. And Chief, thank you very much. It was a pleasure also to meet with you on Friday for a moment, and it gave me some grist for the mill today. The word that came through my mind as we visited with Chief Brown on Friday was the word habit. A habit. Now, this word habit has two Latin roots, and before the Latin, it goes back to Greek and then actually to Sanskrit. I didn't realize that. So the basic word appears in many, many European languages, both those that have more purely Sanskrit root and those with Latin roots. It appears in Latin habitus, which is a place you live, but it also is habeo, which is to have something, to hold something. And they come together in this word habit, the idea of a habit, because a habit is something you possess, but it's also something you live in, right? And the way that works itself out most commonly in a sort of a noun form is the monk's habit, right? A monk's habit is what a monk or a nun wears. It's their religious garb, but it represents the set of commitments they've made over time to live in a certain way. So they wear the habit, but the habit wears them. They put it on, and then once it's on, it tells them who they are and shapes their lives. It sounds to me like for police officers, that's kind of what the badge is. The badge is something you put on, and once you put it on, it's going to say how you're going to behave, how you're going to act. Now, the importance of habits, not so much the physical clothing as our mental clothing, was recognized pretty early in human history. Aristotle, in the Nicomachean Ethics, understands that moral virtue comes about through habits. Virtue for Aristotle was something that didn't come from passion, quite to the contrary. Virtue was a result of your habitual ways of acting, consistent with your training, so that you always acted the same way in certain situations, and eventually it was so habitual you acted in the right way even when situations came like that. And you didn't have time to think it through. You would habitually act in the right way. Again, that's something we heard from Chief Brown on Friday, is characteristic of what a police officer has to develop. There isn't always time, right, to take a course in moral theology first. Virtue becomes part of your character, and you develop that character by habitually doing good things. Now, I think Aristotle would have been appalled by modern people who say something like, well, I am passionate about ending sexual harassment or racism or domestic violence. He knew that passions come and go like the wind. Passions cannot sustain the creation of a moral individual or a moral society. Indeed, this is one of the great problems of contemporary American society. We are a society of passions, a passionate interest and concern for things that are new, but we don't have the moral habits to sustain us through actually changing our society. So a couple of years ago, we were passionate about ending the reign of terror of the African warlord named Joseph Kony. A video on Kony became the most watched video on YouTube of all time. We were passionate about it. And what's happened? Well, nothing. Nothing at all. 5.5 billion hits on the YouTube video on Joseph Kony have had zero result, because passion doesn't sustain concerted action. This year we were passionate about 100 girls kidnapped by the Boko Haram in Nigeria. Remember that? Maybe not so much. The passion's already waning. The Facebook likes are way down. The hits on YouTube for Bring Back Our Girls have been replaced now by a passion for animals and Halloween costumes, although I have every expectation that that will fade as well and we'll be back to cute cats doing cute things with computers. So we move from passion to passion, and it does nothing, and that isn't virtue. Virtue is developing the moral habits that sustain the individual character that results to changes in society. The Apostle Paul, when he visited Athens, went to the Forum. I was going to get to something Christian here. I wanted you to know I was moving in that direction. Okay? I was going to do it all on Marcus Aurelius, but I didn't want to have to go back and read him. I have to sort of keep in touch with the Bible just professionally. Paul, when he visited Athens, went to the Forum to preach because we are told, and I quote, "Now all the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling and hearing about something new." So Paul knew he was going to get an audience there, right? "Despite being the home of Aristotle, the Athenians were a people of intellectual and religious passions. They were always looking for something new to get excited about." But interestingly, when Paul talks to them, he doesn't give them anything new. He tells them what every educated Athenian already knew about God, and that is that God doesn't change, that God is not ruled by passions. Those passionate gods are the silly idols. The one God of the universe isn't ruled by passion. God is constant. And by the way, Paul backs himself up by quoting their own Athenian poets, which showed that he had had the discipline in his life to learn Greek and to learn Greek poetry, even though he was a Jewish rabbi. I say that now because I think it's important that you memorize poems. I had a sixth grade teacher who didn't believe in science, and so that's all we did for sixth grade. Later, I'll be doing a reading of miscellaneous poems from A Gift of Watermelon Pickle. The same thing happens at Lystra and Derbe, by the way. I don't know if you remember the story, Acts chapter 11. It's one of my favorite stories. Some of you may have heard me tell it before. Paul and Barnabas, I'm going to read it for you. "While they were at Lystra, Paul and Barnabas came upon a man with crippled feet. And he had been that way since birth. He had never walked. And he was sitting and listening as Paul preached. Looking straight at him, Paul realized that the man had the faith to be healed. So Paul said in a loud voice, 'Stand up!' And the man jumped to his feet and started walking. And when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in their local dialect, 'These men are gods in human form.' And they decided that Barnabas was the Greek god Zeus and that Paul was Hermes because he was the chief spokesman." By the way, Paul gets really irritated at this. The fact that he's talking means that he's not Zeus. Obviously, Barnabas is Zeus. No, not really. Okay. "Now the temple of Zeus was located just outside the town. So the priest of the temple and the crowd brought bulls and wreaths of flowers to the town gates, and they prepared to offer sacrifices to the apostles." Boy, this is passion, right? One quick healing and already they're down at the temple. They've got bullocks and sacrifices and flowers and garlands. "But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard what was happening, they tore their clothing in disarray and ran out among the people shouting, 'Friends, why are you doing this? We are merely human beings just like you. We come to bring you good news that you should turn from these worthless things and turn to the living God who made heaven and earth, the sea, and everything in them. In the past, God permitted all nations to go their own ways, but he never left them without evidence of himself and his goodness. For instance, he sends you rain and good crops and give you food and joyful heart in their season. Now, this is interesting because Paul's reference to God now goes back to Noah's flood and God's covenant with Noah. And what does that covenant say? As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. God is a constant God. God makes a covenant to do the same thing over and over again. And of course, what he wants is not excitable people, but constant people. People with good habits. These habits are formed as they should be in church. I know Chief Brown's were. And if I can share something you said on Friday, led you to make some decisions early in life about how you would continue to develop those habits in education, including moving a little bit further from bad friends and to the right university. Okay. That's where it all begins, right there. I did not actually develop any good habits at UT, but many people did. Many people did. I was in the band. But this idea of being a habitual, constant people begins with God's gift to Israel and the Jewish people called the Sabbath. Once a week, you will stop everything you do, and you will remember God and remember who you are, that you're called by God. That's the fundamental habit of Israel, is keeping the Sabbath. Christians inherit this Sabbath, and we turn it into our Sunday worship. It's what Eugene Peterson in his book of devotions calls a long obedience in the same direction. And the key there is the same direction. The book of Hebrews chapter 11 says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." And it then goes on and tells the story of the people of Israel from Abraham onward as they continue to habitually move in the right direction. They're like that guy, Robert Duvall's character in The Apostle. He says, I haven't walked the straight and narrow, but I try to cross it as often as I can. That's more or less Israel, but I think that's a good thing to remember. That's what habits are, is trying to cross it as often as you can. And Paul knows that this is what he's about, is developing this obedience in the direction towards God's future. Now, that's not always easy. My house has two Bradford pears in the backyard. They were planted by the developer. That's because the developer wasn't going to be around in 20 years. Now it's been 50 years, and those Bradford pears are way past their sell-by date. As you know, Bradford pears are just not a long-lived tree. They don't last long. They don't represent a disciplined planting. We're going to have to pull them up, and what we're going to have to plant is oak or good native pecan. We're fortunate the people we bought the house from had already planted a sugar maple and a linden tree. Those will last a while, and we've got an elm in front. But Bradford pears are not an investment in the future. I think of the pecan tree at Armstrong Parkway. KERA did a thing on this, right? 140 years old. Because a man 140 years ago said, "I want to keep that tree." And for 140 years, that family watered it and grew it. It's the oldest tree in Dallas. 140 years of obedience in the same direction. But that reminds me of a challenge that Chief Brown and his officers face every day. There are hundreds or maybe thousands of young human saplings in Dallas who cannot see a vision of themselves as grown men and women who will contribute to our society, and in whom, if we are honest, our society puts little hope as well. No parents, lost in school, too often without a church. These young people cannot develop the habits that will slowly lead them into the future God wishes for them, because they don't have a faith in their own future. They don't have any reason to have a faith in their own future. Chief Brown mentioned to us that in many cases, a police officer may be the most constant positive force in their lives. And for that, I think we should applaud the police. That is not easy. I did some work when I was in high school and college over in the projects in West Dallas and elsewhere. It's very, very tough, week in and week out. But while I applaud the police, shame on the rest of us. It's not the job of the police to raise our children in Dallas. And by children, I mean all the children in the city of Dallas who through their own fault are homeless, have no parental guidance, or can't see the future. That's the other long habit that God wanted to inculcate in Israel and then into the Christian community. the care for the widow, the orphan, the childless, and the lost. That's as important as keeping the Sabbath. That's an important habit. It's the very first thing the Christian church does in Acts, right? The very first organizational thing the church does in Acts is say, we need to set aside 7 guys to take care of the widows and the orphans. They do that before they figure out how to worship God right. We know this from Scripture. God is constant. God's love for these young people is constant. But what about us? Chief Brown has challenged us that we have badges too. Badges as citizens. Badges that say something about who we are and the habits we formed. One, by the way, we get to exercise tomorrow. Vote. Right? If you haven't already. In Malaysia, when you went to vote, I lived in Malaysia a long time. When you went to vote, because it was kind of a society of people who were illiterate, and who might be inclined to vote twice. I know South Texas too in Lyndon Johnson's time, but I believe was it Lyndon that said vote early and often? Yeah, and from the grave often too. But when they vote in Malaysia, they have to dip their forefinger in an indelible ink marker, right? And it's interesting because you'll see people on election day, they'll go up and say, see, show me yours. Right? Show me yours. And they don't mean, you know what they don't mean. Did you vote? That's your badge that you voted. Well, a lot of those badges we can't be seen, right? They're invisible badges, but I hope that we'll think about them. And we'll think about the habits that we should have as citizens of making sure that every young sapling in this city gets to grow into a 140-year-old oak tree or pecan or some good native Dallas tree that'll last a long time. Thank you very much. Thank you, John.
Thank you both for those inspiring remarks. Now, I'm from Chicago, and Richard J. Daley can match Lyndon Johnson vote for vote.
There you go.
I'm going to start with the first question, and you probably will have a question as well. Chief Brown, you grew up in Dallas.
Yes.
You went to South Oak Cliff High School.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your growing up years.
Well, my mom was the clear leader in my family, matriarch, and she's come from a long list of very strong women. So we grew up in the church, had to join the choir in church. Sunday school, had to publicly speak every Easter Sunday. My mother made sure we got up and spoke in front of people. And that's why I never write notes, because of my mother. She taught me how to outline what I'm going to say to people at a very early age and to tell them what you're going to tell them, say it, and tell them what you told them, and sit down. I give a lot of, my mother has been the strong leading. And then the second thing is right after coming back from college from UT Austin, I joined Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship Church, where my pastor is Tony Evans, the first African-American graduate from Dallas Theological Seminary here at Perkins School. And he has been a great teacher of mine, and going to church every Sunday from college till now. And I'm just hopeful that all of that investment from my mom, from my church, will continue to pay dividends for me. It hadn't been an easy road. I've had my difficulties as a person, as a man, as a father, as a husband. I really am humbled by the position, by the opportunities I've had, and even thankful for some of the tough times, because I've made it through, still standing. So, thanks.
What question might you have? While you think, I'll ask one more. Tell us about the last few weeks with the Ebola stuff. What did that do for the police?
Really, it just like the public, created a lot of fear amongst the police officers and their families on having to get involved with. I don't know if you know this, intentionally we tried to stay out of the media as a police profession because it was a public health crisis more than a law enforcement crisis, but we did assist in finding a homeless man who was transported in the ambulance after Mr. Duncan was transported, and the homeless person didn't want to cooperate with a quarantine, and he left the hospital and was out amongst the public for about 24 hours, so we found him again and very strongly insisted that he participate in the quarantine. I told my cops, you know, if you got to handcuff him to a hospital bed, I don't care, but we have to monitor him for 21 days before we know he's in the clear. And so the concerns from the officers' families were they going to be exposed in capturing this homeless person to Ebola? And so we had to do a lot of, educating even our cops. And then amongst the public, you know, the two nurses where they lived in Dallas. Once they were found to have had Ebola, everyone that lived in they both lived in apartment complexes. Everyone that lived in the apartment unit where they lived were concerned with being contaminated by a person. Of course, the science doesn't support that, but, regardless of fear. And I was just mindful of, you know, the good Lord hadn't given us a spirit of fear. And so that was a principle from my faith that I brought to the job and was able to, be able to calm people's fears, which can be sometimes our biggest foe.
So, there's a question right over there.
Yes. Yes. Chief Brown, first of all, thank you so much for serving our community. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
As you lead in a city the size of Dallas, do you see a lot of international and or domestic terrorism issues that face you and your officers?
We constantly deal with both the domestic and the international terrorist threats. Of course, you know, our former President George Bush lives in our city, and so those concerns are real. We stay in close communications with our federal law enforcement partners, with the FBI, the local FBI office here. We stay in contact with our Secret Service, has a local office here. And communication has been the key. Of course, we've had more domestic terrorism concerns, it seems, than we've had with international since 9/11. But that's a big part of our job from a homeland security perspective, is to keep the lines of communication. If there are any failures that occur, it's that law enforcement agencies don't communicate with each other. That is the biggest challenge we had, because we can, you know, assemble resources and deal with threats, but if we don't know, you know, that's been the biggest challenge. So we make it a priority to communicate, and we have joint terrorism task force participation from our officers who work with the FBI in a team construct, and that's really worked well. But informing the public and keeping the other agencies all informed from the state, federal, and local levels has been one of the key components of that.
Yes.
Chief Brown, thank you for your service. Also, I would add that many of us in this room are concerned about crimes on women.
Yes.
That have taken place, and it seems like that's on the uptick in most communities. How is it in Dallas, and what are we doing to help them?
Right. So for my whole career as a Dallas officer, it's been 31 years this past August, domestic violence calls has been the number one call. Year in, year out. People that say they love you have had the biggest impact on law enforcement response. People that say they love you committing this crime. And so we have a scourge in our society of not only domestic violence, but sexual assault against our women. And it's by and large, 99% of the time, men abusing women. And we're trying a lot of different strategies to deal with that, the number one being willing to say it publicly, that this is a man's problem. And you can call yourself a lot of things. I'm stealing from the mayor. But you can't call yourself a man if you hit a woman. It's never okay to hit a woman. Now, I'm a mama's boy. So I used to fight in schoolyard if you talked about my mama. I never liked mama jokes. Never did laugh at them, because I talked about how much my mother has meant to me. And so that's the first thing of trying to ease our young men into it's okay to talk about a woman when they start talking about mamas on the play schoolyard. And again, then it goes to the you know, college campuses. And then it's a big joke. And so that's the first thing, is for men to say it's not okay to hit a woman anywhere. Don't remain silent. Talk about it. The next step is for law enforcement is to create strategies to deal with domestic violence that is different than what we've done in the past. So we visit with women who are at risk at a higher level. And I'm going to talk about some things that for your daughters and people, friends of yours, women, if they ever date a guy who threatens to kill them, we call that a clue. We call that a clue. If you ever date a guy who says, I'm going to kill myself, I can't live without you, if you break up, that's another clue. That guy really means I'm going to kill you and me. If there's a gun in the home and there's domestic violence there, that's a threat. And when I'm talking about these examples, the threat where you might lose your life. If the person ever strangles, put their arms around your neck and chokes you, strangles, that is one of the highest risk factors for domestic violence murder. So own a gun, threaten to kill you, threaten to kill themselves, ever strangles you. The last one being the fifth and highest marker for domestic violence homicides is stalking. If your daughter or your granddaughter's ever stalked, and if you have all five, you go and get your daughter out of that situation no matter what she says. Because one of the other sides of this is that people, women in these situations don't leave because of a lot of issues. Sometimes the man that's abusing them is the breadwinner. Sometimes he's going to threat to kill them if they leave. Sometimes because kids are involved, that's the father of my child. And sometimes in their faith, it's wrong to leave the family. And so women are up against a lot of factors in domestic violence that really encourage them to stay. And so the more men that speak out against this, I think that's the big step away from this being okay, this being these women suffering in silence. Because, you know, it's the number one call, but we probably only get half of the reports. Most women never call the police, and they suffer in silence and discourage. And so I appreciate the question and give me an opportunity to talk about that.
Here and then there.
Thank you.
Here next.
Chief Brown.
Yes.
First, let me say I'm thankful that my tailor does not use black buttons. I believe I can join the club. Yeah. But seriously, we commend the force on the decreasing crime in our community. So thank you for that. And other than being attentive to our badges, how can Christian men and women help assist and support your force in doing your job?
Number one, if you are part of any organization, church, or anything related to helping young people, the best way to reduce crime is to prevent it from happening in the first place. And our young people, particularly in our communities of color, are in crisis. They don't have, in many instances, functional adults to help them navigate life. And right now, the police officer is the last resort social service worker. And that is not functional, you know, and we do what we can, but we're the last service, public service, that make house calls. We still make house calls. And so by default, we end up being father, mother, coach, everything for that psychologist, for that child. And so anything you all can do in your church, in your business, to interact with young people in a positive way helps law enforcement and it helps you be safe. Because kids at these crossroads in their life, as teenagers, sometimes as young as 10 years old, are making life-changing decisions on committing a crime, going into the system, and now not being able to get a job. and then the police officer chase them for the next 30 years until they get tired of committing crimes. And so anything you can do, coach, anything with young people, where you can have an opportunity when there's no crisis to sow a seed of a positive adult with great advice for them, that is gold for the police officer.
Yes, ma'am.
Follow up to the domestic violence issue. One of the most critical times when a woman is leaving, and it could be one of those dangerous times, can people call the police and say, we want to leave this situation to get help on that? Or what's the best strategy for leaving?
Yes, there's a part A to your question. The answer is yes. Police can be called to help with that transition and leaving. Part two of that is sometimes they don't have nowhere to go. You say, I'm leaving, but you have no finances to leave. Most of the time you leave with the clothes on your back and your kids in tow. And so what I would argue for you all to be effective in helping this I'm leaving is, you know, the shelter community for domestic violence is in need of resources and funding and support. And so any of your organizations that have any discretionary income or resources to help these shelters, Genesis Women's Shelter. I mean, there's many shelters that need support. Find one and put your money where your mouth is.
Yes, ma'am.
I just have a comment as a follow-up to how can we help you. I personally pray for you all.
Thank you.
Almost every day, once in a while I forget, and I want to encourage everybody in this room to pray for you and your staff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Dr. Hunt.
Yes.
You're not getting off. Tell us about East London. Why is that such a draw for young men now? And to go get in a war.
And to go get in a war. Well, I'm not. I think that I'll just say I think that such a draw. I think it's really a relatively small draw. The small number of cases have been over dramatized. It is the case in the United States that a significant number of African American young men have gotten involved in Islam in much more positive ways. Some in prison, and I think one of the reasons is because they find in Muslim communities an ordered, disciplined way forward, which is the very antithesis of the way they grew up in a community. And frankly, the churches have either, they haven't been touched by a church, or the church hasn't offered that same kind of ordered, disciplined life. And that young men need order and discipline in order to survive and to grow. So I think that's actually the bigger issue, is not the... There will always be some bad people excited by violence, right? I mean, look at your magazine racks. We have magazines here in the U.S. dedicated to mercenary soldiers. And they've been there a long time, since I was a kid. There have always been young men attracted to that. I think a bigger question or challenge to those of us as Christians is, why are there a significant number of young men who find a disciplined, ordered life in Islam that they didn't find in a Christian church? And I think we should just acknowledge that and be challenged by it.
Let me follow up on that question. We have lots of different cultures in Dallas. How does the police force deal with so many different cultures?
Right. We have taken this challenge of dealing with the very diverse number of citizens in neighborhoods in our city by really pushing a community policing strategy forward in every neighborhood, and not cookie cutter relationships, because what may work in one neighborhood may not work at all. It may be a serious failure in another neighborhood. And we have really taken on the challenge of creating community policing programs around young people, because you get the kids, like any salesman would tell you, you get the parents. Somehow the parents go where the kids go. And if you do something for anybody's child, you're likely to have a good relationship with the parents as well. And you're also likely to impact the child in the way they choose and make decisions for the rest of their life, create a friend. But even if you don't create a friend, that child ends up going against what the officer tried to do. At least you know who they are and when they become a criminal. You can deal with them much more easily. And so again, the diverse communities we try to deal with through community policing, and we try to really target young people in our community policing efforts in these diverse communities, because whether it's Hispanic or Asian or other or black, the children are really the way you define a neighborhood, and we really target very our highest crime areas more so in these relationships.
Let's thank our two speakers for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, John. Chief, thank you very much.